me start by saying that I agree with you. It's an insane title for a podcast. How can criticism of Amy Coney Barrett and her religious positions, which are based in Catholicism, possibly be regarded as anti-Semitic? But first, having caught your attention in this way, let me make sure that I have invited you to subscribe to this podcast, to share it with your friends, and of course, if you are reaching us via Apple Podcasts, to give us a 5-star rating, because this is the way that a podcast grows out of the crowd and becomes something to be reckoned with and something people actually listen to on a frequent basis. So your help is much appreciated, especially if you appreciate the argument that I'm about to make, because I can actually explain it to you. I got to break it down. First of all, we have to understand what anti-Semitism is and where it comes from. And then we have to understand what the Jewish perspective on abortion is. And then we can see that, in fact, it is true. And there are probably any number of you that are already getting ahead of me and get the idea. But it's actually true that the criticism being leveled against her is anti-Semitic on a certain level. So again, let's start at the beginning. What is anti-Semitism about? Why is it that throughout 3,000 years of Jewish history, the Jews have always been hated simply for being who they are? Well, I'm going to read you a medrash. I'm going to show you a medrash that was shown to me by Rav Shalom Friedman, who is the director of the Amud Esh Holocaust Memorial Museum in New York. And it really spells it out pretty clearly. At the beginning of Parshas Matos, the second Aliyah, which for the English speakers is chapter 31 of the book of Numbers. Chapter 31 of the book of Numbers. And God spoke to Moses, saying, "Seek the vengeance of the children of Israel from the Midianites. Afterwards, you will be gathered unto you, your people." In other words, you, Moses, will pass away. And it is credited to Moses that rather than running away from this final task, he was just told, you're not going to die until you accomplish this task. I want you to do the following, and then you will die. And Moses, to his great credit, does not delay doing what he was instructed to do. Wouldn't you naturally say, if God just told you you're not going to die until you do X, you're going to spend thousands of years not doing X? Moses was not that way. And that's probably why God felt he could tell Moses that this was the case. "Seek the vengeance of the children of Israel from the Midianites, and then you will pass away. You'll be gathered unto your people." Next verse, 3. "And Moses spoke to the nation, saying, arm yourselves from among you, men for war, and they will be against Midian, to give the vengeance of God in Midian." Now, wait a second. Verse 2, in which God spoke to Moses, God said to Moses, "Go take the vengeance of the children of Israel from the Midianites." And Moses turns to the nation of Israel and says, "Go take the vengeance of God from the Midianites." Whose vengeance is it? That's a fantastic question, is it not? I mean, we know it's a fantastic question because the Medrash asks the question. Medrash doesn't ask dumb questions, but it really is. It kind of screams out, if you just read the verses, you may not have noticed it, but it's kind of an obvious, when you think about it for a second and you just stop and think, it's like, wait a minute. God says to Moses, "Go take the vengeance of the children of Israel." And Moses says to the nation, "Go take the vengeance of God." Who's who? Who is actually being, you know, who was the aggrieved party here? So the Medrash talks about this particular contradiction, pointing out that the two verses say opposing things about whose vengeance, whose justice. What was this about? Says God to Moses, He says to the children of Israel, says the God says to them, this is only your justice, because they caused me to damage you. Meaning that what the Midianites did was entice the Jews away from Jewish behavior, got them to do immoral things, got them to violate the behavior they were supposed to do, forcing God's punishment upon the Jews. So it's the Midianites who did that. So God says to Moses, go seek justice, your justice, from the Midianites for what the Midianites did to you. And Moses says, Master of the world, this is reading the text of the Medrash again, if we were uncircumcised or served idols or denied the commandments, they would not hate us. And they would not be pursuing after us. Rather, it is because of the Torah and the commandments that you gave us, and therefore, the vengeance is yours to give the vengeance of God in Midian. See, the Medrash explains it perfectly. It was actually an argument. It was as if Moses corrected God on the record. God says, this is your problem. You need to seek justice from the Midianites because they got you to sin against me. And Moses says, well, that's true. Yes. But the bottom line is that they only care. They only chased us. They only wanted to get us to sin. They only tried to damage us in this way because we have this obligation to function by the moral code that you, God, gave us. So you see, it's about the moral code. The reason why the Midianites cared to get the Jews to sin, why did they hate the Jews? Why does any anti-Semite, bottom line, why do anti-Semites hate the Jews? Hitler was very open on this point. He said, they call me a barbarian. That's a great title. I want Germans to be ruthless and cruel. And, you know, this was their desire to abandon moral values. He said that the Jews inflicted circumcision on the body and a conscience upon the soul. That's, you know, notice that that's the same thing that the Medrash pointed out. The Medrash said, if we were uncircumcised. Because the idea that Jews do a particular procedure, a permanent change to their bodies, because God told them to do it. And then God said, you have to watch out over your shoulder because I'm watching whatever you do. That's something that the barbarian does not want to hear. So all of those things inspired Hitler to hate the Jews. And it's been that way all the way back through history. It's also the same reason why the Midianites hated the Jews. Moses tells us so. It's recorded in the Bible. So if that's the reason, if that's the problem, then hatred for these moral values comes from that same root of anti-Semitism. It is anti-Semitism, as I said, at a certain part. Now, there's much made of the supposed difference between the Catholic position on abortion and the Jewish position on abortion. But it's not nearly what some groups would have you believe. The National Council on Jewish Women, for example, a group of liberal women. I wrote an article about this, which I will link, that appeared in Newsweek, because this group, the National Council of Jewish Women, presented a document that claims that Judaism permits abortion full stop. And that's simply not true. It's absolutely false. The idea that human life has value, that neither abortion nor infanticide was a good idea, comes from the Jews. Look at the Greeks and the Romans and how they behaved, and for them, infanticide was no big deal. It's explicit. I mean, go look in the historical record. all of the values that a first world civilization follows today, including the idea that every human life is sacred, comes from our school of thought, comes from our Bible. So this idea that life begins, I mean, first of all, when this decision was made in Roe v. Wade, that a woman has a fundamental right to an abortion, which of course is found nowhere in the Constitution. The justices just did it as a matter of their own school of thought. They made a moral judgment which secular justices have no right to make. But also it was counterfactual. Claiming that life begins at birth is counterfactual. We know today, which we did not know when Roe v. Wade was decided. We did not know at that time that a baby in the womb, I mean, I think people knew this anecdotally, but it hadn't been studied and understood scientifically. A child in the womb gets used to listening to his or her mother's heartbeat and his or her parents' voices, and comes out into the world already recognizing when laid against his or her own mother's chest, it has a calming effect that nobody else can have because it's his or her, it's the home heartbeat. It's the one that that child grew in the womb familiar with. And the voices of the parents similarly have a psychological effect on a child the way that other people's voices do not. So that means that the child in the womb is a sentient, thinking being. There is nowhere on earth, in any other circumstance, nobody challenges the idea that a sentient, thinking being is alive. That's the very definition of life. Is that the body, at least, it's a person capable of thought. I mean, on the contrary, nobody counters the idea that a person who is in a vegetative state is alive. It may not be a, you know, there's a whole discussion about brain death, yes. But if a person is in a coma, but essentially an extended dream state, there's no argument. Even though that person cannot do anything right now, that person in a coma is thinking. That is a sentient being, and a sentient being is alive. We all understand that a sentient being is alive. So I would argue that Roe v. Wade is actually contrary to science as well. But it's certainly contrary to Jewish morality. I was actually, you know, amazed to discover, I had always thought that the Catholic school of thought was to believe in no abortion ever. But no, in Catholic ethics, at least now, if this wasn't true in the past, I can't vouch for that. But today, it is true that even in Catholic schools of thought, that to terminate a pregnancy, intending, the goal should always be to save both lives. But if there's some medical necessity to terminate the pregnancy to save the life of the mother, even if the child is likely to pass away as a result of doing that, it is still, to them as well as to us, a permitted practice. In fact, to us, it's a commanded practice. If there is a conflict, saving the mother's life and saving the child's life, the child being the dependent life, as it were, if the baby is killing the mother, you have to remove the baby from the mother. That's the way Judaism looks at it. But that doesn't mean that the baby's not alive. That doesn't mean the goal is not to save both. It's a tragedy when you have to terminate a pregnancy, and all the more so when terminating the pregnancy brings the baby to a premature death. I mean to say, obviously, preterm. Terminating a pregnancy is a great thing to do after 9 months, but just the idea that the baby needs to be delivered early is not considered a good thing. And it never should be done intentionally simply to get rid of the baby. That's absolutely contrary to all Jewish values and Jewish ethics. And it's on this basis that they're going after Amy Coney Barrett. That's the point. They're going after her because she is following a Jewish ethical principle, an ethical principle that comes from us, that termination of a pregnancy should never be done to kill the baby. And by the way, that should have nothing to do with secular jurisprudence. The whole problem with Roe v. Wade is, once again, that the justices inserted their own moral judgment. They decided that a woman has a right to have this done. She has a right to control her own body. If we actually believed that, suicide would be okay. We put people in institutions to prevent them from taking their own life. So you're telling me that a woman does not have the right to take her own life, but she does have the right to take the life of the unborn child within her? It doesn't work that way. I mean, logic doesn't look for that way. Science doesn't look at it that way. And it's a moral judgment that a secular justice should never be making in the first place. The only reason they're attacking her is because they created a situation where secular moral judgments replaced religious ones, where they reached a judgment that lies absolutely outside the realm of secular jurisprudence. And because she is able to distinguish between what secular law requires and how secular law should be decided, and her own religious moral judgments, and she simply doesn't share their willingness to inject personal moral judgments into secular law, therefore they're demonizing her as if she's the one who's confusing religion and state. On the contrary, because she holds the traditional values, she says, look, I'm not going to get my own values involved here. There's just no such thing as a right of a woman to terminate a pregnancy. That doesn't exist. That's something for states and democracy to decide. It's not for a group of 9 justices to impose on the rest of society. And by the way, everything that I've just said is even on the assumption that she would be willing to reverse Roe v. Wade. If you reverse Roe v. Wade, it's not saying that abortion should be prohibited across the country. It's saying that it should be returned to the hands of the individual states. New York, for example, has already said that if Roe v. Wade were reversed, they're going to allow abortion to continue right up until birth. And the justices are not creating a federal law that would prohibit that practice. So that's not their bailiwick. So nothing that she is doing is mixing her religious values into the state, but the attacks upon her are not only attacks on religious values in general, they're specifically an attack on a Jewish religious principle, which, as the Medrash tells us, is at the root of anti-Semitism. So there we are. Once again, if I have impressed with you with this argument, I would urge you to please subscribe if you have not subscribed already to the podcast, to share it with your friends, give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts, and otherwise just help more people to know that the Moral Heritage Podcast exists and that I'm trying to share a thought like this with you as well. I'm not going to say a timeline because you know I took a break for several months, but we will be back soon, I hope. Thank you so much.